Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from: a curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hello, this is your host, Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly. Today, I am extremely excited to have someone on my show who I've admired for a really long time. In fact, last night when I was preparing for this interview, I was reading to my daughter all kinds of details about today's guest. And she was like, "Mom, you are fangirling. I have never, ever heard you fangirl before." And, you know, it's kind of true because I'm not really a fangirl by nature. But what can I say? I am so happy to have Debbie Mazar as my guest today. You probably know her from like something like 70 appearances in different like TV shows and movies. She got her start in Goodfellas. She is Maggie on Younger. But I actually got to know her a little bit at South Beach Food and Wine back in 2014 when she and her totally sexy husband, Gabriele Corcos, is that good?
That sounds great.
That's good, yeah. I'm trying to roll my tongue with that. They were doing a demonstration because they had a TV show called Extra Virgin, which I think is a perfect title for you guys. and they were cooking. They had somehow entered my universe, this foodie universe. And now they have this incredible book called Super Tuscan: Heritage Recipes and Simple Pleasures from Our Kitchen to Your Table. So, Debbie, welcome to Speaking Broadly.
Thank you, Dana. It's so great to be here.
Okay, so our lives have indeed intersected in very funny ways. You know, you were at Danceteria, like, in an elevator with Madonna, who was not yet your best friend, but became one. And I was kind of on the outside. And I was shopping at Fiorucci, you know, back in the 70s and buying, like, I still have those clothes and the posters.
It's amazing.
Well, we both really love clothes.
Yeah.
And you were hanging out, you know, with Joey Arias, right? I mean...
And selling Mary Paul's jewelry there. The rubber bracelets, you know, the earrings.
So, yeah. So there was that.
Yeah.
And so there was this moment in time where we intersected, and then life took us in different directions. But we've ended up in this amazing food world. But I want to hear your road to this incredible food place. And, it, you know, it starts in New York. We both started in New York. And you, your mom was 15 when she had you, mm-hmm. which I find extraordinary since I have a 17-year-old daughter. And that,
wow.
you know, notion of her having a 2-year-old is mind-blowing. But it did not sound like food was part of that beginning of your life too much.
Well, my mother could not cook. At all. In fact, food was a part of my life in the sense that my grandmother was a stellar cook. However, and I used to like sit on this little chair next to the sink and watch her, and I would go to the avenue with her shopping cart, and there was the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker on Jamaica Avenue. And she, you know, would always, I mean, you know, the butcher had sawdust on the floor. And she really tried hard. She would make that kind of food that like casseroles, kind of like 1940s food.
Uh-huh.
You know, it had like butter. She would say butter. And it had this sort of like fake English accent when she pronounced certain ingredients.
I love that. Is there something about the Mayflower?
Well, that's the story. I mean, it's we are Smith.
Okay.
On her side, and her, they were from Boston, and supposedly somebody came over on the Mayflower. But, you know, I think a lot of people have that story.
Okay.
I don't know how many people fit on the Mayflower, quite frankly, but I love a good story, you know, and that's what I've been told. And my grandmother, you know, very much tried to play that card, and, you know, she was, she had a Masonic pin.
Wow.
Yeah, and, you know, it's, I'm actually like half WASP, which people would never assume about me.
No, I think the accent took a great transition over time.
Oh, absolutely. And also, my hair is actually blonde. And people don't know that about me.
Wait,
either.
It's
the color of my daughter's hair. Yeah.
You have blonde hair.
I dyed my hair like when I was in my 20s. And I've been many colors for film. But the dark stuck. I got married as a brunette. He finds brunettes attractive. And I fear that if I let my, you know, blonde roots go and just went for it, I wonder if he'd be looking at brunettes.
Well, you are such an iconic brunette. That's why I'm sitting here almost speechless, but not completely.
Yeah.
To know that you are a blonde.
I'm a blonde.
But, you know, I feel like it fits your personality in that so many of your choices are very intentional. So you're intentionally
yes.
a brunette.
Yes. And, you know, I've been typecast, but I figure as long as I'm working, why not?
Yeah.
And I don't care.
And the typecast is working for you. Your grandmother was a great entertainer, right? She loved to have people over.
Yeah. I mean, she set a beautiful table. She always had crystal dishes out and vintage kind of kidney bean shape pottery around filled with, you know, her version of what she thought was chic, whether it was like a liver pate or she would even like put inside of a celery. She had some kind of like gorgonzola inside of celery, you know, and she loved wine and to make cocktails. So I got the food thing going with grandma. Mom kind of didn't really have that together. I have a very distinct memory of when she finally became a great cook, and it's when we moved up to Saugerties.
I was wondering, because I knew you moved to upstate, but I wasn't sure, so Saugerties.
Okay. So yeah, that happened in the early 70s. She opened up a health food store. She was growing on our land, you know, vegetables and marijuana. and she became this great cook. She made, the first memory I have of something wonderful was tacos. She made like the best tacos. It was Mexican, but it was great. And
I wonder how she even got that in her head.
Well, you know, she's a New York City girl. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's a multicultural place where we have Indian food and every kind of food here. So, but, you know, she became this great cook. And for me, when we moved back to Queens, I always lived in a building that had, you know, Black, Puerto Rican, Chinese, whatever. And I would go to everybody else's house for a meal because they had the grandmother or whatever, and there was always something smelling great in the building. You know, when you walk into a New York City building, and like, especially, it's funny, like, I live in Brooklyn now, and I live in a house, but they're wooden houses, and there's houses, like, right next to each other, and on Thanksgiving morning, it wasn't my house that smelled, it was everybody else's, and it just, like, was wafting into my bedroom. You know, and so I got the love of going to people's homes, and it really sparked my interest in cooking and also entertaining. I'm a Leo. I like to party. I like having people over. I like a good discussion. And so as a young woman who left home early, I just started wanting to cook to entertain my friends, have them come over.
So and, what was your go-to dish? I'm sure you must have had one of those.
You know, I've always been able to obviously do pasta. Who can't? Yeah. I mean, pasta is the easiest thing to do in the world. But stews was my go-to thing.
Okay.
Always loved to make a beautiful stew, you know, whether it was chicken or beef. You know, you throw everything in a pot.
Yeah, there's something very simple, very satisfying.
It's homey. And it's comfort food. Yeah.
So, okay, so when you were hanging out with the Keith Haring crowd.
Yeah.
What were you eating? Like, I kind of need to know. Were you going out all the time? Like, you were hanging out at the Mud Club, and you know, what were you eating at 4 a.m? And then what were you?
We were doing coke. We weren't doing.
There's no eating going on.
No, I'm lying. I actually never really loved coke. We didn't eat a lot because we were. I was involved in a crowd that really drank a lot of water, and smoked a little bit of marijuana, and we would dance all night. We would just dance. So we would dance until the sun came up. I dance with mostly like gay men at like the Paradise Garage. And after we were done dancing, we would generally either take the train to Jones Beach and go like cook in the sun, or we might go into the East Village and go to a place called 103.
Oh my God, my favorite place. I went there every Sunday because the sausages.
Yes, they were delicious.
Fantastic. Yeah. I still mourn that place because it's 103 actually
103 Second Avenue.
Absolutely.
Or Kiev.
Yeah.
Or Veselka or one of, so we would go to like one of those spots that was open, you know, all night long and have generally like eggs.
Yeah.
You know,
they had great eggs at 103.
Or chili or, you know, Kiev had this mushroom barley soup and no one had money. So we would just kind of eat. Or we would go to Dave's Luncheonette that was on the corner of Canal and Broadway and have like a hot dog or a hamburger with a lime Ricky. You know, and it was a total 1950s. I mean, one of my favorite places also at the time to go was during the day for lunch was, what's the name? Dubrow's. Dubrow's was on 7th Avenue and 39th Street. And it was one of the most incredibly designed places. It was total, like, modernist space, 1950s. All the garmentos, all the old Jews worked there. They all had gangster hats. It was a place to go to get dressed up. So women would actually have, like, full-on wigs, lashes, characters. And they would all come out of work. They would even travel if they were retired to come here during the day. And for $4.50, you could get, like, roasted chicken, kasha, maybe what do you call this? Whatever. You can get like a bunch of great stuff and Jello and a cup of coffee for $4.50 and listen and like people watch.
That sounds divine.
It was so good. It was so good. I used to live above Manganeros. Do you remember Manganeros? So I would smell every morning like garlic and sauce coming up, you know, wafting into my apartment. So, you know, it was like there's always been food around me because I've always loved to entertain. I've always lived above restaurants. and you know, for me, once I met my husband, I don't know if I should be segueing so soon.
I'm going to ask about moving to California because then, you know, you moved to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Actually, I love the story of when you were, I think you were doing the makeup for Speed the Plow.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Madonna would leave and Joe Montana would leave and...
Yes.
Ron Silver would leave, and then you get on stage and, like, you know, say all the lines. And
it was very All About Eve.
I love that vision of the dark house and, you know, taking the stage, and then someone saying, oh, my God, you can act.
Well, it was funny just because I knew all the dialogue, and I had always been used in people's videos. They're like, yeah, you look cute, or you're funny, or, you know, like... Here, come and do this video with us. So I've always been into visual arts and never wanted to be an actor per se. And then all of a sudden, after I started assisting in the opera doing makeup and seeing more theater and then doing makeup in the theater, I was like, wait a minute. Like, this is great. Like, I kind of want to do this. I don't want to always be behind the camera. Like, I want to be on camera or... performing, and it seemed really cathartic to play other people and to kind of get emotions out that might be bottled up inside of me, but I could do it like through somebody else, so it's like not as scary. Yeah. And when I did Speed the Plow, it was Speed the Plow, not Goose and Tom Tom. That was the one play where like I just knew every line because I had to be there every day, and as I'm doing like a monologue, I'm done, and I, it felt really good just to do it. you know, and I saw like fake people, and, but then but then all of a sudden I heard,
oh my God.
And I was, oh my God. And there was the costume, like lady out sitting out there. And she goes, you know, you're really, really good. You should just like, if that's something you want to do, why don't you just go take some classes? And I hadn't really thought about doing that because I didn't have time. It wasn't like I could go to acting school. I was already on my own having to pay rent, and I just didn't know how it would be possible. You know, I just figured everybody started that, like, you know, when they have their parents' support, and that wasn't happening. So I figured it out. And I went to HB Studios. I studied with Marsha Halfreck and Bill Hickey and Uta Hagen, and I found my way, you know, into classes, and you know, I cleaned studios to help, you know, to try to barter for things and gave haircuts.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Did people's makeup. And it all worked out. And then finally I decided to audition for an agent.
Uh-huh.
I lied and made up a fake, very simple resume saying that I was a newcomer, but that I had done X amount of theater and blah, 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 because there was no internet.
And no one could check you.
There was no IMDb.
Yeah.
you still were allowed to lie about your age at the time. And you know, and I got an agent. I think I auditioned with a John Patrick Shanley play.
Oh, yeah.
It seemed like material that would be, you know, close to the cuff. And I got an agent, and then that was the beginning of it, you know. I auditioned for Scorsese for Goodfellas. That was my first big major movie.
Yeah.
And then that kind of took me into the stratosphere of, like, Spike Lee, Oliver Stone. Started going to California, kind of doing the back and forth. And then I decided to, you know, go dip my hand after a while into television. Because I grew up on TV.
Yeah.
I had a young mother, and I was a product of 19—well, watching 1950s and 60s TV that was in reruns, like I Love Lucy.
Yeah, oh my gosh, how perfect for you for inspiration.
Oh, yeah, with my grandmother on the black and white TV that was built into some fabulous wooden case. You know, you know, we used to watch, like, Perry Mason together, and— a lot of Betty Davis movies because she would love to watch them. And I think that's why I still smoke, which I'm trying to quit. But, you know, to me, it looks so glamorous.
Yeah. You're pretty glamorous without the cigarette. So
I know.
You could probably drop that.
I should drop it. But I'm actually, my next project, I've been told I have to smoke.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a really good excuse for you.
Yeah. And I was going to quit before that. So I'm kind of like, oh, all right.
You'll
another couple
after.
Of months.
Yeah. It won't be too long. So so that brought you to California. And was that exposure to all that beautiful California produce, like, did that shift your mind?
I remember visiting California before I went to live there. I visited a few times. And I remember just driving down Sunset Boulevard and rolling up towards the Beverly Hills Hotel in the evening. And it was like the Beverly Hillbillies came alive. Like, all of a sudden, I started seeing all these Technicolor shows in my brain. And it was mind-blowing because, you know, it was like the lights that were under the palm trees and the architecture and the colors and the bougainvillea and the night jasmine. I was just completely, like, overtaken by the beauty and also the sensorial throwback to everything that I saw on TV growing up. I was just like, oh my God, this is great. Oh my God, I can have avocados like in my backyard. Like, I still miss California. I love California. I love everything about it. The whole, like, Annette Funicello surfer movement, you know, Beach Boys. I mean, I'm young for that era, but I loved it. It was just fun, you know? Growing up, you know, watching all those Technicolor movies and stuff, and then me getting behind a wheel and driving a car, being a New Yorker.
Yeah.
I was like, woohoo, yeah. And I just would sing my heart out and drive. And I was friends with wonderful people like Seymour Cassell, Cassavetes actor, and, Barbara Streisand's first husband, Elliot Gould, and different older people, men and women, that would take me around Los Angeles and say, oh my God, like, this wasn't here 30 years ago, and it was desert, and tell me who lived where. And Clark Gable was here, and Carol Lombard, this was her house, and you know, and I got to wear like Mae West jewelry, and it was just, my whole ride there was magical, because I got to work with great actors, meet great writers, going to homes that were fantastic with incredible gardens. And you know, the funny thing about California is that nothing is really seasonal there. So you can go to the farmer's market and get strawberries year-round. And they don't taste like they do here, right, or in
no
crappy Italy.
Strawberries. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like these big, ginormous strawberries, you know, that taste like nothing. So there were some culinary throwbacks for me that weren't so good about California. But I just love, for me, that in my garden, I had an avocado tree that dumped like, you know, hundreds of avocados into my front yard, where I would take some, I would cover my body in a bathtub in avocados, my hair, my face. I gave them to all the neighbors. I had baskets in the front for people to just take them. I had oranges, grapefruits, lemons. You know, it just that's just paradise to me.
That sounds like paradise, yeah, to me too. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about another paradise, which is Italy, and we're going to talk about,
yes,
this amazing book and the delicious recipes. One of the things, when I was, you know, reading the recipes, I just thought, I can do this. Like, they're all so direct, delicious, doable. So come back, and you're going to hear about these amazing recipes for everything from cranberries to zucchini, and it'll inspire your next set of cooking and entertaining. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. One of the nice things about Bob's Red Mill is it's the only, that I know of, national supplier that's easily available for lots of interesting, hard-to-get grains and other seed products. So, you know, before Bob's Red Mill became widely available, you couldn't go get something like quinoa very easily, or you couldn't go get spelt easily in small quantities. But now you go to any one of the huge number of stores that carry Bob's Red Mill, and you can get smaller amounts of these really interesting, fun things to play with. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Hello, welcome back to Speaking Broadly, and today my guest is Debbie Mazar, and we are going to go deep, deep in the world of food, and we're going to start with one of the great How We Met and Fell in Love stories, which is Debbie and Gabriele. So tell me, what about that night when you met your husband?
I'm a workaholic, and I decided it was time to take a vacation. So a friend of mine was on tour, and she said, why don't you come down to Barcelona, and we'll meet in different countries, and you can stay in a hotel close to me or with me or whatever. We'll have fun. I'm like, bet, done. So I started out in Barcelona, and then I decided to go to Florence, where I had met a woman named Katia Lebec. She's a French classical pianist. Her and her sister Marielle, they play grand pianos together. And she's, wow, been around, like play with Miles Davis, like jazz, classical, fantastic. She owns half of the Marais in Paris. Like, she's like a French, you know, icon, who also happened to live in Florence at the time. And she said, Debbie, you must come to Firenze when you see me, because I'd love to see you again, and I have a house there, you'd be my guest. So I'm like, bet. Okay, girl. So I called her up. I'm like, listen, I'm coming to Florence. Can I stay at your house? It was in Piazza Santo Spirito, which is a very old piazza, wonderful 12th century church in the middle of it. And And her townhouse had frescoes everywhere, and like the vines are protected by the Historical Society. They're like 600 years old, and there's a long wooden table under this, you know, this canopy of beautiful vines. And we would have dinners where she would put candelabras out and have like the best, you know, Brunellos and blah, blah, blah. So I go there, and Gabriele was supposed to pick me up at the airport, and my plane never showed up. Long story short, I managed to get there, and that night when he walked in, it was like sun rays were coming out of the back of his head, and he had this big smile, and he spoke English, and he was really charming, and I was wearing marabou-trimmed chancletas, which are like little like slippers that had like some marabou on. He was smoking a cigarette, and the ash fell, and like my shoe went on fire.
Oh, no!
And I was wearing a cat.
That's coup de foudre, which is in French, you know, it's like love at first sight. So,
well, yeah, it was kind of like we giggled, and I was wearing a cat on a hot tin roof slip. Now I was shoeless, and you know, surrounded by good wine, candlelight, and a cute Italian man. So I said, "Who's that guy? He's kind of great." She goes, "Oh, that's Gabriele. He's really nice. He comes from a nice family, and you know, he's a conga player." Like a conguero, wow. No. So he's kind of like my Italian Ricky Ricardo, because he played Cuban music, which I always had this affinity for, being a fake sort of Latina wannabe. And the next day we were sat at a table. He said, "You want to go get some cigarettes?" I'm like, "Yeah." And we went to the piazza. We got a cocktail. Ironically, it was a caipirinha.
That's so funny.
Yeah, and we sat on the steps of this 12th century church, and we proceeded to drink and chain smoke, and talk about life. And by the time we walked back to the party, he goes, "You know, you're fantastic. We should have kids together." And I'm like, "What?"
That was a little fast.
Oh, yeah. No, it didn't really hit me in that way. It was just his honesty, and he just blurted it out. And when we walked into the party, our dynamic changed, where all of a sudden I sat in the chair next to him, and I kind of like put my back up straight, and we were kind of shy all of a sudden, and it was really, really cute.
It was so cute.
And yeah, and then he kissed me goodnight, and because Italians kiss on both sides, I didn't know to go left to right or right to left, and so our lips bumped into each other, and electricity went through me, and literally the door closed, and I sank down like olive oil, like not the little oil, like Popeye and olive oil. Like I sank down on the floor with my legs straight out, like, "Oh my God, what just happened? Who was that?" And like, "Oh my God." So the next day he was ordered to take me out and show me the town, and he did. And by the end of the day, we kissed near the Ponte Vecchio. And that was the beginning of us dating. I held out for, I think, like a week. And actually, I said, "You know, I have to go to do Madonna's makeup." She fired a makeup artist, and I got to go to Milan to do her makeup. Would you like to come with me? And we stayed at Villa d'Este.
Oh my gosh, how beautiful.
Yeah, and that's where we consummated our first evening together, in that beautiful hotel, on Lake Como. And from there on in, that was like, we just fell in love. And then I asked him to come to Paris with me, because Madonna still needed a makeup artist. And I said, "You know what? I have an apartment to stay in of my girlfriend and Katya." And we were there for a week. And that was kind of like my honeymoon, because we saw people getting married coming out of Notre Dame.
Oh my goodness.
It was beautiful. It was the summer. And then he said, "Hey, what? Instead of going back to New York, why don't you come and spend the rest of the summer with me at my apartment?" And I did. And he had an apartment on his family's estate, villa, you know, very simple place, but beautiful, beautiful land, like 20,000 olive trees. And he had a really simple, rustic apartment with like wood beams. And he just started cooking for me. And we were playing house. And by the end of the summer, we didn't ever want to be apart again. And we never were. Like, I came back to L.A. I said, "You know, listen, I'm like a workaholic."
Right. You might not recognize that, because I just said yes to spend the summer with you. But
yeah, American on vacation. But, you know, he was so great. And he really, like, his mother, he loves his mother, which is a big deal for me. And he, between cooking, being able to fix anything, like, he was kind of like a Renaissance man, completely. A great cook. very, very like strong. As skinny as that man is, he is strong. And he's a real like farm. He's a real farmer. So I found it very sexy. And he came to L.A. And that was it. We got pregnant. We got married all in less than a year and bought a house.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot. And then you guys did this internet show, which I really loved, Under the Tuscan Gun.
Yeah.
And it's the two of you. Like, there's a camera. It's, like, obviously on a tripod or something. Yeah. Shooting the, and that was the beginning of your cooking show. How did you even decide to do that? And Gabriele, he wasn't really, he was a good cook, but he didn't have pretensions or desires to be, a quote-unquote chef.
No. He was in the music business. In fact, he gave up a world tour with Shakira to be the conga player to stay home to be the dad. Because he said to me, oh my God, I have this audition for Shakira. I'm like, go for it. Because I knew that I'd married a musician. And I don't believe in squashing people's dreams. I knew what I was getting myself into. And I really wanted him to like pursue it. I'm like, great, do your thing. So I had the baby in my arm. And I'm like, you know what? It's your decision. I'm not going to like stop you, and you have my support if that's what you want to do. You'll be on the road for 2 years, but you know, maybe I can come see you, whatever. We'll figure it out. Just go for it. And he came to me like a day later, and he goes, you know, I thought about it, and I've waited my whole life to meet the woman I love and to have a child. He goes, I don't want to miss this, so I'm not going on the road. So he didn't, and that was fine. And it was great, actually.
More than fine.
Yeah, and he was always a very good cook. He was raised by a family of women that, and his father, who all were fantastic cooks. All of his friends are fantastic cooks. He's a very rustic cook. He deals with simple ingredients. And the funny thing is that when we met, I tried to impress him with my cooking. And he was impressed because I make different things that are not Tuscan, that are not even Italian. But he would always take my recipe and Tuscanize it, which is what my second book's about, basically, and make it better. Like any of my stews, all of a sudden he's dumping like the meat in the liquescet thing, done much quicker with a bottle of Chianti poured into it, you know, or half a bottle or whatever. And he just always cooked better than me. So... And because I was pregnant and I was really hungry, because I used to be really skinny. I was born thin. I always was a size 2.
Yeah, you were.
And I was petite. And
you're still small.
Well, no, but I had unusually small bones. Like my waist was a 20.
Wow.
You know, and I ate like a pig. I also exercised. I was very athletic. But we're just like, you know, built thin. I was anyway. So... He fed me, and I was hungry and pregnant, and I think that my body just wanted to eat everything that, like, the baby needed to grow. Instead of having, like, a slice of mozzarella, I would take the whole damn ball. I mean, it was, like, kind of gross. Like, I would pick the ball
That's
up.
A lot.
It was a lot. Yeah. But my body, I was never into milk, and my body was, I needed to build bones, I suppose. Like, I ate what I needed to eat. I never liked meat. I liked it here and there, but I wasn't a big meat eater. All of a sudden, I started craving, after I had the baby, steak. Go figure. Hamburgers. So my husband started feeding me, and he was so much fun to watch in the kitchen. We put on our Cuban music, and we would dance around the kitchen. You know, he would have his beer. You know, later in my trimester, I'd had like a little half a glass of wine, which totally got me buzzed. We would giggle. And after the baby was done breastfeeding, we just kept it up. And we would just put the camera on us. Because at my wedding, he was so well-spoken. He's so educated. I mean, he studied to be a neurosurgeon. He's so well-versed in a lot of different topics that I just thought, like, you know, between the cooking and, you know, the fact that you're able to cook and talk, like,
that's actually unusual.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm like, truly. Let me direct you. Let me direct you, because I had so much experience on camera. So I'm like, stand up straight. And I made fun of his pronunciation because I found it cute. But the way that he's a good editor and I'm a good director and...
it makes a perfect pair.
And we had, and I've always been a flea market like whore. So I had all of the beautiful dishes and ways to serve things. My kitchen was pretty. The way it was presented was pretty. And we just started posting it before YouTube. And once YouTube launched, we kind of blew up the internet in our own way. Like, not like Kardashian way, but and for us, it was a big deal. And we had no publicist. And I know that I'm a working actress, but our story was genuine, and the food world embraced my journey into food because no actress was trying to do a show at the time with food.
It's true. You really came way before.
Yeah.
And very authentically so, which is why it's so nice today to talk about the journey from the beginning to here instead of saying, you know, hey, and you did the show because... In fact, now so many people have jumped on, like, I cook all the time, but you really.
Well, it was funny because I went to the last upfront at Food Network, the last upfront I went to as my show was ending, Extra Virgin, and they had, like, actors, some I had heard of, some I hadn't, cooking, and four out of six of the videos were them shaking, like, chicken in a bag, like, shake and bake. And I was like, wow, like, why? Why not have an authentic cook on, or somebody who's a plumber? Like, why does it have to be like an actor, or you know, bring this, turn it into like a celebrity thing? For me, I never felt like it was a celebrity thing. Like, we were trying to share culture and share family and share how to, you know, simplify Italian food so it's not like la 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 la, you know, like some American Italian, like pizza, Frankie, Johnny, Vinny, you know, like let's put the meatballs on the spaghetti kind of thing, you know. Yeah. That's not what we aim to do. We aim to show how the Romans ate, the Etruscans ate, and really kind of share a cool history. And also just to, you know, it was our own like journey in terms of like exploring how to feed kids. We didn't know. You know, what they would like and whatever. And we've been trying to like shove garlic in their food from day one just so they're, you know, adjusted to the taste. Like any culture that, you know, has curry or strong hot peppers or whatever.
I love that you are so attracted to the research because one could think, you know, the great thing about Tuscan food is its simplicity, mm-hmm. right? And that's what I love about your book is that I was flipping through and found recipes to make tonight.
Oh,
and,
right on.
And because my daughter loves zucchini and she...
Are you doing the zucchini and brie?
I'm going to do the zucchini boats that have the ricotta and the flesh and then the onion mm-hmm. sort of, and then toasted with breadcrumbs and parm on top. Mm-hmm. So I can just imagine how delicious that would be.
You're getting me hungry.
And the... That Tuscan food, you could say, you live on a farm, it's very simple, you don't really need to know so much, but in fact, because you like the research, it informs it so much more, and because you're cooking in America, so it's not just that you were cooking in Italy and brought these recipes, like, you actually cook every day, like, I believe that, and I should, because you do, but it's...
Such I did order pizza honest. Last night.
Okay, you're confessional, right?
No, we actually, we cook, out of 7 nights, we probably cook 5. Because now my children are older, and because they live in New York City, one wants Thai food.
Of course.
The other one wants Jamaican food. And, you know, and I want to eat a salad, and my husband wants to have a steak. So we've come to this kind of fork in the road. Now, like really, it's interesting because trying to make everybody happy.
So, how do you resolve that?
I have what's it called, caviar.
Sure, you just order in for.
I order in. It's New York City. It's really easy. But I don't like to do that too much because I feel like I don't want my children to think that like our house is like a restaurant where they can just like say what it is they want. I'm like, no, this is what's on the table.
Yeah,
and if you don't want it, you can go upstairs. Like, my daughter will sometimes, like, go, like, I'm not eating this. And she'll go and rip open a box of that mac and cheese that toddlers eat.
Like Annie's.
Annie's, exactly. Which is delicious, actually.
I eat that out of the leftovers.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. After they've gone to school. But, you know, I don't like that children should be able to turn food down. I think that's very wasteful. And they have to appreciate that there's hunger in America, not just hunger around the world. You know, hunger exists, you know, in their school. Yeah. My daughter would often bring food for her friends because they would come to school with candy,
not the most nutritious start to the day.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they've come further in terms of school lunches, but not that much further. It's pretty gross.
And so the dynamic between you and Gabriele in the kitchen.
Oh my God, we have fun.
So how did that play out in putting together this book? Because it's a mix of recipes. Are some of them you're really attached to, and some he's pretty attached to? Or?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that because we both love food, some holidays, like say Thanksgiving, they're not his holiday. They don't have that in Italy, and he doesn't like white meat because in Italy, for instance, the chickens are much smaller. So they give the chicken wings to the cats.
Oh boy.
And so he was like, when he heard about like Super Bowl Sunday and like all these chicken wing recipes, he was like, what? And I'm like, well, Americans really love chicken wings. Yeah. And so he developed, because I love to have people come over because I love a party. I could care less about football. I like to watch the commercials and I like to see the halftime show, you know, and then, you know, drink and have appetizers and, you know, make fun food. And so he just decided to like make a really good, you know, basting for the, you know, make a nice sauce and figure out how to Tuscanize it. That's what he does. He Tuscanizes everything.
So he's the Tuscanizer.
He's a Tuscanizer. And for me, you know, like that's one example, the chicken wings or the turkey. He'll wrap the whole thing in pancetta.
Okay. And anyone who's listening, you actually have to go onto Debbie's Instagram and look at this pancetta wrapped turkey.
It is so good.
A thing of beauty.
It's beautiful.
And I have to believe it tastes really
porn.
Good too.
It's good. I mean, it's so juicy.
Right.
And it just gives the turkey a little extra flavor because it's, you know, turkey by itself, unless you're dumping some gravy on it, can be kind of bland.
I mean, you could take that pancetta and you could wrap a chicken with it too, because
anything.
Like people get kind of bored of turkey in it.
But you know turkey, what we do? We do a turkey loin that's boneless.
Uh-huh.
So I actually had that the night before Thanksgiving. I'm not sure why he chose to cook that night, but he wrapped the turkey loin in pancetta and sliced it like a cake.
Beautiful.
So it was like, you know, easy to cut, easy to cook, delicious. And I highly recommend that for people's Thanksgiving that don't want to have the whole damn bird in the stove and take all that time.
I think there's been a real movement towards, like, you know, breast only. It's like, oh God, those legs, and no one eats them, and they cook at a different time, and that's such a pain. And yes, I think we've become much more practical with our birds.
Yeah.
You know, just admitting their challenges, the sad state of the bird. And what is your very favorite recipe in the book?
You know, people ask me that question, and I don't have a favorite. I mean, I'm hungry all the time, and that book has just a lot of delicious things in it. I mean, there's a great stew, there's a great pasta, there's a great cocktail. I think the Boulevardier is my favorite cocktail. I love whiskey.
Uh-huh. And you love beer.
I hate beer.
No,
my husband loves beer.
Oh, he loves
beer.
He
loves beer. He's an IPA dude. I'm not a beer drinker at all.
Funny.
Yeah. I like wine.
Uh-huh.
I'm a wine girl. And to a fault. Like, I'm like, all right, there's so much good wine out there in the world, and it's so wonderful to drink it. But at the end of the day, it's like super caloric, and it becomes like a thing because I'm in the food entertaining business, whether it's acting or the food world. Like, there's always good wine around.
So you got to try it.
I mean, but life is short, and I'm like, you know what? So fuck it.
It makes me really able to say no to the bad wine.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, no, you cannot tempt me. You know, like,
yeah.
You crappy wine at a literary salon, no.
Yeah.
I can say no to that because there's so
it
much good
wine. It gives you strength. Absolutely.
It gives me strength. Yes. So what do you think the commonalities are between acting and cooking?
Well, you know, it's sensorial. I mean, you know, there's nothing really that similar. I mean, for me, I never thought about comparing them, quite frankly. To me, cooking is a survival technique. You know, I grew up having to cook because I didn't like what was being put on the table, and I enjoy it. It makes me relax. Acting for me it's not so much about my ego, but it's something that I really like doing. It's my job.
Uh-huh.
And I get a thrill out of it for the most part. It makes me laugh. It inspires me. It makes me think. Where food nurtures me and it takes me on vacation. Acting takes me on vacation too because I get to make money and then I can go on vacation. But, you know, it's funny because at the set we have probably the worst food. So I don't put acting and food together. It's funny because now, since I've had a cooking career, I guess over a decade now, people always write it into the scenes that I'm cooking. Like, you know, Maggie on Younger is a stellar cook. She's always got a wine glass in her hand, and she's always cooking. I think Darren Star also really loves wine. He loves good food.
Yeah.
So that's just part of it. But, you know, it's all a celebration of life. And so is acting in terms of the fact that it's like, you know, it's celebrating emotions. It's putting it out there so people can relate and feel like they, too, can process a good feeling or a bad feeling, that they're not alone. So I think in the times that we're living in, I think that food is really comforting, alcohol is really comforting, and entertainment is really comforting because I woke up this morning and there was so much bad news on that, like, that's why I like to, you know, like, binge watch shows now. I find that a very, very wonderful luxury.
I'm with you. And I like binge watching with a bowl of popcorn. So that's my...
Yeah.
And so working with your husband, obviously you guys have so much fun together, but is there anything about the two of you are both Leos and, you know...
He's not a Leo. He's a Libra.
He's a Libra. But you both like being in the spotlight to some degree. Does that create any challenges?
Oh, no. No, because we're very different. He actually... never thought about being in the spotlight. I kind of threw him into it, and he's good at it. He's really good at it. And he likes to tell a story, but it's never a problem because he accepted who I was. I'm a Leo. I was very out there. I was a celebrity before I met him. He didn't even know who I was. Not that I'm anybody, but
he
didn't know.
It's kind of charming, though.
Yeah, it was great. He didn't like know my acting stuff, and like his friends were like, she's that girl from Goodfellas, like, you know, but he didn't. He wasn't really like, you know, watching films and TV very much. I mean, he did on his own stuff, but different taste. It's never been a problem. He lets me be who I am. He lets me, you know, sparkle. He never puts out my fire. I think if he did, I couldn't be with him. And the same with him. Like, I let him shine. He's like, you know, we're two pretty happy people. We're both type A personalities, and working together can be very challenging, especially since I'm very vocal about how I produce things, and I'm also a tough New York bitch who's like knows where the budget's going. So I often have to call people on stuff and be the one where he's a little bit more polite. He grew up as a good mama's boy, and he went, you know, to military school. He's better than me in some ways because he knows how to hold his tongue, and I don't. So we balance each other, but I'm usually the bad guy, and he's the nice guy, and he also has helped me to have more patience. He's taught me how to be more patient. I still always have one eyebrow up.
That's the new
if I don't have Botox, I can raise my eyebrows. I really am one of those people that just like, I'm like, wait a second, you know, and I know the hustle and I respect the hustle, but at the same time, don't hustle me.
Right.
You know, so because I really want to put the money into the product, into the production on the screen. And that has been hard in a marriage, working together, doing a show where we've had to shoot in our own home. Whether it was California or Tuscany, have people involved in my business, having a network use my children on screen, how to protect them, how to say, I have final cut, you know, and to exercise my place that I've earned. And it's been really, really fun, but not easy because I really always wanted to put the right thing out there and not make it about reality or some schmaltzy little road trip show or whatever. Like, I always have respect for the quality of what I'm putting out there and what my voice is, because it's out there forever.
It is. And I took, you know, such a luxurious bath in your past, you know, all parts of it, as I said at the top of the show, just, you know, luxuriating in it and sharing it with my own daughter to say, look how inspiring, you know, this way of life is that you and your family lives, and how you share it with people. And
it's only a peek, really. You know what I mean?
I know. It's like a little piece of the curtain. I'm sure you pull the curtain back more. And
oh, it's not so pretty all the time.
More. But thinking about family, which is at the core of sort of everything you do, because you you love to entertain, but you also love to create the sense of family, mm-hmm. family and friends, and then the Italian family and the New York yes. family. What are the sort of the words of wisdom that you would share as your last thought here, that really the words of wisdom you'd give to your daughters, you know, the way to live your best life?
Well, I think you have to, you know, choose your path wisely. Don't waste time in things that don't really matter, whether it's love that's not going well or issues at work, or if you don't like it, move on, figure it out. There's no time to waste. Be strong, have balls, do what makes you happy, you know, eat well, take care of your health. And if you want to like see something in the world, just go see it. Because there's no time. Figure it out. There's always a way to figure it out. It's not about money. There's always a way to do something. And choose, you know, make your choices wisely, because, you know, and your words, because you can't take certain things back, and you can't, once you have kids, that's it. You have kids. Like, you can't change that. And you want to, you know, choose your mate carefully, your lover, whatever, your partner. But just have fun, enjoy life, because we never know.
Yeah. I love the notion of time. And one thing that struck me,
I'm a catastrophist, by the way.
Oh, what does that mean?
Oh, it means that I'm paranoid about everything. So I'm like, I got to live my life. I have to live it now and without fear. I'm afraid of a lot of things. I'm a bit of a catastrophist. I think it comes with hormones, to be honest with you, or with children, of loving people so much that you worry all the time.
Right. So your notion of time is actually stretched throughout the book, which intrigued me, because in your lessons to the reader, you're saying, don't waste time, or I do this because it's not going to waste time. Like, put your utensils out on the counter. Don't waste time looking for them in your drawer.
Right.
You know, and I just think that that's, I'd love it when someone's philosophy penetrates every single part of their life.
Oh, so yeah, it's like, where are the jewelry? Don't put it in the safe.
Right.
Like, just
who's
going to
go in the safe?
Right, no, yeah. You got to, like, same thing with the things in the cupboard. Like, get rid of all those fucking spices that you don't use. Like, I have, like, 20 cinnamons and 20 cloves. Like, get rid of stuff and just, or use the stuff. Like, just use the things that you have.
Yeah. Okay, so, my dear husband, if you're listening, so I can throw out everything in that spice drawer, right? Because it's all...
It's probably old.
It's old. It's half dead. It's true. Well, with not the thought of half dead, but the make the most of every moment, I want to say thank you, Debbie, for joining us.
It was so much fun.
On Speaking Broadly. I want to thank David Tatasciore, the amazing engineer, Carlin for being the best listener ever. And Debbie, if people want to find you, where would they find you?
On Instagram, Debbie Mazar, at Debbie Mazar, DEBIMAZAR. The same thing with Twitter. Or, you know, on some random station or on the New York subway.
And you can find me, Dana Cowan, at FW Scout. And as always, send your thoughts my way. If there's people you would love to hear me interview, or comments or questions, I actually love real mail, but I also love, you know, DMs on Instagram. So have a great week, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.